And joining us now is Rebecca Hamilton, who is an author and journalist who teaches at Columbia University Law School and was a legal correspondent for Reuters. She covered the civil war in Sudan and was a special correspondent on Sudan for The Washington Post and a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her latest book is Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Hamilton.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And Rebecca, you were a lawyer with the International Criminal Court and, of course, the leader of now Northern Sudan, or Sudan, has been referred to the International Criminal Court. What are the chances following the UN report on the use of chemical weapons in the Damascus suburbs on August the 21st, assuming that the attack is attributed to the Assad regime, will this lead to a referral of the Assad regime to the International Criminal Court?
Look, one can't say with certainty before the debates at the Security Council tomorrow, but certainly I think it's more likely than it was even, say, 2 weeks ago. I think the conversation is starting to shift and you're hearing more discussion of the possibility of getting the ICC involved. But for the International Criminal Court to become involved in Syria, it has to come through the UN Security Council. Syria has not joined the court. So the court doesn't have the authority to go and investigate what's happening in Syria without the UN Security Council asking it to go in there.
And that would be subject then to the Security Council would be subject to a Russian or Chinese and or both veto, right?
Exactly. And the stumbling block until now has been the Russians. The UK proposed this a while ago. The Russians gave a very clear sign that they would veto any such proposal. But we're seeing these pieces shift. Since we've had the proposal come about the disarmament of the chemical weapons, you're seeing, I think, a bit more creativity on the diplomatic front and a little more openness towards exploring alternative options to the U.S. military strike. So I think, you know, there's no certainty that we'll see a referral to the ICC, but I think it is, again, more realistically back on the table.
Well, of course, the British have been, from the beginning, since this chemical attack, they have been trying to get a resolution based on R2P, the responsibility to protect. Where does that stand? Is that what you're referring to?
In their original draft resolution, they were talking about R2P, but as an additional component, a referral to the ICC, because there's sort of three prongs that are working in parallel. There's the diplomatic or political, there's the legal prong, and then there's the possibility of military action. And so, you know, I think if we get to the point where we do have a referral to the ICC, I think what is crucial is to realize that is, in and of itself, not going to change the dynamic in Syria. It's just one piece of this much more complicated puzzle, and we need all of those three pieces, the political, the military, and the legal, to be working in concert, which is something that we haven't had up until now.
So would the precedent be for the fact that you just said it wouldn't be necessarily change things in Syria? The precedent would be what happened with Sudan, where General Omar Bashir has been indicted, I guess, by the International Criminal Court and is still in power.
Right. And this is a very difficult thing for the ICC. It has no police force of its own. And so it relies on states to actually enforce its arrest warrants. Now, I think there's a particular obligation on the UN Security Council when it says to the ICC, you take this on. We think this is an important issue. We want you to be responsible for accountability here, to follow through that referral by supporting the ICC and actually executing its arrest warrants. And that's the kind of political support from the UN Security Council that we have never seen in Sudan. And I think if there is a referral to the ICC on Syria, it's crucial that the Security Council backs it up with political support to actually execute the warrants that the ICC would issue. And the other thing that the UN Security Council has been doing, it did it both for the Sudan case before the ICC and also the Libya case before the ICC. It asked the court to take on accountability, but didn't give it any funding to do so. the court is funded by the states that have joined the court. But I think there's a good argument to be made that when the Security Council is effectively outsourcing to the court, then it also needs to provide some funding to enable the court to do its job really well.
But it's worth noting, Rebecca Hamilton, that the United States has not signed on to the ICC. The Clinton administration at the executive level did, but it's never been ratified by the Senate.
That's right. And, traditionally we international lawyers have sort of struggled with the fact that the US has, when it came to Rwanda, when it came to the former Yugoslavia, been a supporter of international criminal law. And then when it came to the ICC, backed out at the last minute. But that was under the end of the Clinton administration, certainly the first term of the Bush administration. But from the second term of the Bush administration, and even more so under the Obama administration, you've seen a softening of the U.S. position towards the ICC. They didn't veto the referral of the ICC on Sudan and similarly with Libya. So I think you're seeing, I wouldn't say that they're ready, that the U.S. is ready to join the court, but certainly it's much more open to the court's existence. And I think, if Russia was not going to veto it, certainly the U.S. would not be vetoing a referral on Syria to the ICC.
And again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Hamilton, who is an author and journalist who teaches at Columbia University Law School and was a legal correspondent for Reuters. She covered the civil war in Sudan, where she was a special correspondent on Sudan for The Washington Post and a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her latest book is Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. But I find it a little hard, though, to see, Rebecca, the Russians not vetoing, given what Putin wrote in his op-ed piece in the New York Times, that he insists that Syria was not behind, or the Assad regime was not behind, the chemical weapons attack on August 21st. And indeed, he went on to say that the jihadis, who he holds responsible, did it as an act of provocation to bring the Americans strike in, and that the jihadis were going to use chemical weapons against Israel.
Well, one thing to understand about the ICC is that when it gets jurisdiction over a situation, it gets jurisdiction over the entirety of the situation. It never gets jurisdiction just to prosecute one side. So in terms of alleviating Russian concerns, the argument would be, and whether they're persuaded by this or not is a separate matter, but the argument would be this is an independent international court that can look at war crimes committed by all sides. And while certainly it would seem that the vast majority of crimes have been committed by the Assad regime, we also know that there have been war crimes committed by the rebel side. And the ICC is not going to be partisan. It will be looking at war crimes committed by all sides if it gets jurisdiction over the situation.
So just turning, Rebecca Hamilton, to the broader humanitarian crisis in Syria, how would you, since you spent so much time in Darfur and in Sudan and in South Sudan, and I think we spoke when at the time of when South Sudan got its independence. So my question would be, how does this humanitarian catastrophe in Syria compared to others, given I think up to 6 million have either left the country or are internally displaced out of a population of, 20 million?
Yeah, so, I mean, firstly, I should say I haven't been in Syria at all during the crisis. But in terms of speaking with humanitarians that are operating out of Jordan and of Turkey, I think that what you're seeing is this mass displacement of people such that even when we can't get great access to what is happening inside Syria, we see as people flow over the borders the sorts of situations that they're facing. And right now, we have the world's attention focused on Syria, which makes it easier on the humanitarian side to secure funding for donor operations. Doesn't make the security situation any easier for them to operate in. But at least there's funding coming through. The risk is that this conflict continues to go on. It's been going two and a half years longer now. Darfur, for example, went on as going for a decade. And at some point, the international community starts to lose interest, at which point funding for humanitarian operations drops off. and concerns about the security of the humanitarian operation delivery service also drops down. So that's a concern as we as resolution takes longer and longer, is that issue is always in play. But I think any of these situations where you have mass atrocities, it is always the civilians that are bearing the brunt of it. And the other sort of dynamic that we see that is similar in terms of when it takes so long for the international community to find a workable solution or to help parties find a workable solution, is that you have a fracturing of the opposition, you know, what it is now compared to what it was 2.5 years ago. And that is also very bad for civilians.
Well, indeed, it's the part of the opposition, the al-Nusra Front in Syria, that issued a fatwa against the Syrian Kurds, which prompted a massive migration, spontaneous migration of Syrian Kurds into Iraqi Kurdistan. And I did speak recently with an American journalist, Max Blumenthal, who was in the camps, the refugee camps in Jordan. And he said that the Jordanian military are controlling these camps and really don't want any more people in there. They certainly don't want to integrate them into Jordanian society. So they're bottling them up in the middle of nowhere without any water or sewerage. And just across the border, there are thousands and thousands of Syrian refugees trying to escape from Assad who can't get in. So,
right. And yes, I mean, it's always the fact that the neighboring countries, the regional, when you have a regime that is so destructive, the consequences can never stay inside the country. They have to flow outside, and then so it's destabilizing for everyone in the entire region.
But is that a reason for the world to get more involved? Because much of what we've heard, I've heard over the last couple of years, is basically, you know, a plague on both their houses, and the U.S. doesn't want to take sides, and, you know, the American people are against any intervention, and the president, in spite of his threat to use force, may not be able to carry out that threat.
Well, I think the American people are it would seem at the moment against any military intervention, but that's a very different thing between to saying we're just not going to get involved at all. In other words, there's a long way between doing nothing and dropping bombs, as it were. And it's this track of political, diplomatic, and legal that I think the focus really needs to be on. And you know, often helpful if it is backed up by a credible military threat, but that should be a matter of last resort. And I certainly think it's unclear to me how the use of military force would actually assist the Syrian civilian population at this point. But if you can get to a resolution that works on the diplomatic and legal front, that seems to be the best chance for the civilian population.
Well, Rebecca Hamilton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Hamilton, who's an author and journalist who teaches at Columbia University Law School and was a legal correspondent for Reuters. She covered the civil war in Sudan, where she was a special correspondent on Sudan for The Washington Post and a Pulitzer Center grantee. Her latest book is Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the new Gilded Age.
I'd be